Welcome to The Learning Curve, a show about helping kids get good grades in school and succeed in life. The Learning Curve is for parents, teachers, and students, because all of life is a learning curve, and you'll succeed to the extent that you can learn easily. Now, here's your hosts, the authors of How to Learn, How to Teach, Overcoming the Seven Barriers to Comprehension, Roger and Virginia.
Today's guest is Dr. Leroy Nunnery. Dr. Leroy, I think we better refer to him in the more friendly terms as Lee, has a stellar record, actually, in school renaissance is what they, the wording they used. He was actually the consultant that conducted the Renaissance School Project for the Philadelphia School District in 2008 and 2010. This is really exciting stuff to get our heads around, listeners, because this is the sort of thing that all parents can benefit from if they participate in helping get their school districts look at how better they can do the job. So, welcome, Lee.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with both of you.
Thank you. First question I've got on this Renaissance School Project is, what did you actually research and study on that project as a starter?
Well, the district, like most urban districts, faced an enormous set of challenges. Low graduation rates, aging buildings, a lot of fits and starts in terms of the path of its curriculum and its program. And I think as public officials, parents, communities, and others kept looking at the problem, especially under the then superintendent, Arlene Ackerman, the call went out to find a way, develop a strategy that would turn these schools around. You know, I think it all depends on how you define turnaround or renaissance. Our definition ultimately was to ensure that, A, every child has equitable resources or access to those, B, that we would work towards closing facilities that were either old or had too much deferred maintenance, C, that we would try to affect the staffing in schools, hiring and firing, to make sure we had the best quality available in each building, but also to look at external options so that if there wasn't enough capacity internally to turn a school around, that we would go to a charter operator or some other organization and offer them the opportunity to turn it around.
Yeah, and put their muscle behind it. And so what was to be studied was effectively predetermined for you by the school district, or did you come up with what should be addressed?
Well, we did a little bit of both. I think, Roger, the challenge, even for Philadelphia, with a long history of this kind of uneven performance, is that even as you compare to Chicago, Dallas, New York, Washington, I mean, the movement's been going on for a while,
right,
or looking at even what the federal government had been promoting as a way to get resources, you had to change your system. No one single application would work across the country. You would have to tailor it to fit your particular circumstances. And that's where the rubber meets the road.
That's exactly right. As an old consultant myself, I so well understand that. That must have been a real try-on to actually, you know, get in and address the specifics of this particular area.
Well, absolutely, because so many other efforts had been attempted, are still going on. Not everybody agrees with the core strategy, and the biggest challenge I thought was, and I still think it's there today, is that not everybody can come to agreement on what the outcome ought to be. You know, essentially answering a question, and that is, what does a good school look like? What does a quality, high quality school look like? And until you can really wrestle with that question, even though it sounds very elementary, it becomes a challenge, excuse me, to implement any strategy.
And that actually brings me to two questions, which you kind of answered already, in that I was wondering if you had used a model that other school districts or another school district had used. Did you use several models and tailor them to Philadelphia school districts?
Well, Virginia, yeah, we tailored what we did based on several different models, past experience from the superintendent because she had been in Washington, D.C., Seattle, and San Francisco and had effectively made similar inroads or made similar attempts. And we looked at Boston, where they had a novel collective bargaining agreements with the teachers' union, allowing for teachers in a particular school to vote for longer working hours and different work rules as part of a turnaround strategy. We looked at New York, where they created a series of shared service organizations so that a school could elect which services it needed to affect change in its particular building. And we combined and blended some of those elements in order to come up with our own program.
That also brings a question to mind, and that is teachers' unions or the teachers. Did you get the teachers involved in this?
That's probably the greatest challenge, and the reason why, even with all of the effort and the money that we were able to apply, we have had some but not great success. Mm. In other words, a new collective bargaining agreement was structured about 3.5 years ago. It called for fairly intensive involvement and engagement by the union, not only that union, but also the union for the principals. But I think they would say, and I can say now that I'm no longer at the district, that safely say. I don't think the involvement was nearly as intensive as it should have been. There is clearly a role for getting the teaching professionals into the deep discussions. Not that they weren't there at all, but it's all in the application. The devil's in those details. And mm-hmm. I don't think that there was always the day-to-day type of engagement that should have been there.
Well, the tragedy of a lot of these from top-down, if you want to use that word, kind of reorganization efforts, they tend to end up being put on the teachers rather than addressing what the teachers are actually doing in the classroom that would end up with kids actually learning. And so in many respects, it's like if we want better grades in schools, trying to reorganize schools isn't necessarily the right target. The big question, and really the $64,000 question, is in the study and in the consulting project, what actually was learned that you were able to then form some recommendations for change and improvement?
Well, we learned a few things, that the parental engagement was hugely important. So just like we talked about teacher engagement and staff engagement in devising a solution, maybe even more important was parental engagement. Yeah. So as part of the decision around how the school would be managed in the future, we did a request for proposal, received responses from external providers, then used those responses to a very intensive selection process, and the finalists, maybe three or four, were presented to community groups or school community groups, and they effectively voted on which provider they thought was most appropriate for their particular school. It was messy, it's hard, for a whole lot of reasons,
mm-hmm.
Not the least of which is that parents want to be involved, but educators have a way of creating language that suits them and not
right.
the parent.
Well, doesn't every profession, though?
Every profession does, and then on top of that, people have, over the years, we were talking about, have a deep-seated distrust for solution A, B, or C. They've seen it before. What does this mean? We actually get a chance to weigh in on how a school spends its money. I mean, there are a lot of questions that have to be answered if you're going to talk about quote-unquote parental engagement.
Yeah.
But at least it got going, and it's in its third year, going on its fourth year now, and we kept refining it as we went along.
But wouldn't you say, way back when this country was established and the whole idea of having the public vote for people who will represent them was so novel and new, and it was probably very, very messy, wouldn't you say that it is an evolution and people learn the language and learn how to handle the process? Do you think it's going to actually end up making the school district stronger?
I'd agree that the evolution of an idea like this, real active participation, is in fact something that can be learned. But a lot of this depends on your ability to parent, to have access to that information. To be able to get to a meeting means that the hours of the meeting must be held at a time when you don't have child care issues or you don't have a second job.
True.
I mean, there are a lot of roadblocks that, or barriers maybe, we'll put it that way, that really have to be encountered and thought through carefully. And as I've advised folks in Memphis, Tennessee, and other places, Washington, D.C., about parental engagement, as well as how to do it in the context of school turnarounds, it becomes evident that a lot of school districts wave at the idea of parental engagement, but don't really know or embrace what it means. Does that mean, for example, that a parent can come into the school at any time and say, I want to see my child's teacher or I have a problem, and get met with, instead of resistance or smirk, get met with a courteous, open embrace?
Right.
And access to information. I mean, those are two diametrically opposed ideas.
That sounds to me like that actually is almost a change in perspective. And you know what? You're right, because the old perspective is the teacher is almost next to, second to a doctor, I guess you might say. And whereas nowadays, perhaps we should be training or teaching parents to be more like consumers.
Absolutely. Oh, this is, V, you nailed it. I mean, that to me, I've been saying that probably since our overlapping days at Edison Schools, that when you decide to move, if you have children, you usually move to a place that has a good school
right.
in your system. You will do, as we did here, even pay high property taxes and yet send your kids to private schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting how close to the issue of consumer preference that the selection of an educational path and then the decision of involvement really is. I mean, it's tied closely. So how do you lift the veil on school performance? When you get a report card at home, what does that mean to you? Mm-hmm. Does it signal anything?
Yeah.
So going, kind of flipping back to the Renaissance issue, if you're really going to try to revitalize, or change a school, you've got to have this one component working incredibly well. It can't be overlooked, or else what you'll get are maybe better rules inside, maybe even better, a new coat of paint in the building, but it won't change the level of activity between the community and the school itself. And the school has to be seen as a community asset.
Well, actually, I would have to say that I have some great hopes for this, because if you think about it, look at how the delivery of medical services has really changed, where people actually, rather than saying, oh yes, my doctor told me to do this, so therefore I'm going to do it, to people getting on the internet and doing research themselves and going in with questions and asking their doctor and making decisions on their own and actually acting like a consumer. It's taken years of getting people to do this, but it's finally coming around, so I have hopes for schools as well.
Well, I do too, and I think that with the access to technology, as you mentioned, the ability for, you know, using iPads or whatever the tool is to personalize curriculum. I'm spending a lot of my time now on blended learning, on the area around how to not only enable education by technology, but to integrate the technology into the education so that I can tell how my children really learn and what problem sets to give them. And I don't have to wait for a teacher to dole that out. I can go directly to the source.
Right.
Or I can create my own.
That's an important point. We'll actually explore that further later on in the interview, Lee. The thing that I've got my attention on is, so what changes were implemented as part of the Renaissance project down there in Philadelphia, and what was the actual outcome of it all?
Okay, so the major changes were the following. For now 3 and probably 4 plus years now, there have been a set of schools, or a subset of schools identified as failing or struggling. And after a pretty rigorous analytical process where we give them effectively a number from 1 to 10, 10 being the lowest. And out of X number of struggling schools, a small handful, maybe 5 to 8, are selected to go through this transformative process. Now, generally, that means they have additional monies coming to them because they are Title I schools, which means the kids have are living in households below a certain median income, or they're in the case of stimulus money, there was additional stimulus money. But each of these buildings now would be subject to either an internal plan for turnaround, which we called Promise Academies, where the district made the decisions and created essentially a school within a school, or they went to external providers, charter school operators, who could come in and convince folks that they had plan.
Right.
So we've done this now for 3 years here in Philly. It's been done in other cities. Reports are created to on a quarterly basis to measure providers on a pretty rigorous set of terms and conditions. And although it has not happened yet, it could happen that if a provider is underperforming in terms of attendance or graduation rates, if that's appropriate, or test scores, or any number of measures, their contract would be cut and they could be replaced. So far, from groups like Research for Action and others that have been studying this for a while, we understand that our turnaround schools are as good, if not better, than some of the charter schools that are not part of this process. So that's a good thing. That said, there was so much money available then to do this work under stimulus pre 2011 budgets that you had flexibility. Now, with budget cuts being the theme of the day, I am concerned about how Renaissance can actually be continued and sustained.
The follow-on question to that is, how were these changes implemented, or what were the actual outcomes? I mean, the ideal outcome is improved performance with the kids and better graduation rates. Did we see this occurring? Of course, it's early days, is it?
Well, it's still relatively early, but the signs are very promising to the extent that either for the district-operated schools, in one case, Martin Luther King High School was treacherous for a while in terms of school violence. It was designated a persistently dangerous school, which means that there were incidents. I'm trying to think even in terms of suspensions, you could account for probably 2.5 suspensions per kid at that school at one point. I mean, it was
really
ridiculous.
Mm.
Yeah, it was really bad. Now, the school has turned around. It's quieter. Community groups and houses of worship have invested time in the school, offering everything from wrestling clubs to chess clubs to robotics. So I think Roger, that the needle is moving in the right direction. The test will be everything from college admissions to the ability for these young people ultimately to get into careers and to keep showing up. The experiment works, let's put it that way.
So given the different circumstances in each school, did you have different measurements of success for each school?
Either if you were an external provider or internal provider, the goal was... It was multifaceted, so it really did call for lower incidence of school violence, lower suspension rates. So to make sure you got that, the tool of in-school suspension was created as opposed to expulsion. To increase graduation rates, we looked at the weakness in reading and math, particularly for entering ninth graders, because they are the ones who ultimately are the most challenged. So we did any number of things like that. Again, part of the problem is, it's garbage in, garbage out on data.
Yep.
So you have to religiously collect it if you're really going to make something work.
So we're listening to Dr. Leroy Nunnery, who's the consultant who recently performed the Renaissance School Project down in Philadelphia. And he can be reached through his website at www.pluultra.com. LLC. Now, I'll spell that for you. It's in the French vein. It's PLUSULTRELLC.net. So, Leroy, the thing that caught my attention there, you were mentioning a little earlier, just before did the reintroduction of you there, you were into hybrid learning, particularly with your son. Tell us a little bit about that, because that's something I think that our parent listeners here could very much benefit from.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity, first of all, to talk to you all. I think this is terrific, what you're doing, not only as a source of information, but also as a, quite frankly, an aid to those who are interested in education, and particularly for lifelong learners. You know, I got into education. I'm a business person turned educator. I've been fascinated for some time now about how technology, either gaming or using instructional technologies, could help to further education. So I read, I study a lot about this, and this is not the originator of this by any means, but a big proponent of having education personalized so that you can, as a child or a parent, navigate your way through your lifelong educational pursuit by understanding not only where you are today, but what it's going to take to get to that end. So, for example, if I know that Virginia has a propensity for math and science, rather than defeat that and have her move at a pace that is slow and probably disinteresting for her, I should be feeding that by restructuring her curriculum around that strength.
Yeah, we actually had a guest a few weeks ago on the subject of gifted children, and that was a very key point that she made as well. It's so valid to actually speak to and address and facilitate the strengths of your kids, find out what they are, work to furthering them.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how actually excited I am for the kids of the next couple of generations, because, you know, you think about an iPad or a tablet, imagine what they're going to have in just a few years.
Yeah.
And the ability to grab information and to structure it in a way that is appropriate and appealing. And then if you look in higher education, edX from MIT and Harvard, Coursera, Minerva, I mean, they're on and on and on. There are just so many opportunities to distill and to distribute information. So I think this is going to be huge for a lot of people, particularly folks who generally have not had access.
Right, yeah, MIT and all those boys, they've actually put their bachelor degree, science and all that sort of stuff, on the internet. Folk can go study it for free.
That's correct.
Yes, it's wonderful. Actually, the point we're speaking to here, Lee, is one of the points that we made in Chapter 2 of our book, and that is one of the barriers to learning and comprehension is that kids quite too often are being made to sit and listen to and have rammed down their throat things that they see no value for, no use for, no purpose for paying attention to it. And of course, they do poorly in those subjects. The converse of this is that when you find something that a child is tremendously interested in, then they soak up knowledge in that area almost by osmosis.
That's right.
Well, it was Maria Montessori who said the child has the absorbent mind. All you need to do is let them loose, and the child just absorbs it like a sponge. Exactly.
So with your own children then, because you raised this point in the context of your own kids, what are you specifically doing here to help them with the hybrid learning model?
Well, mine are older now. They're almost all three of them are in their 20s and more. So I think that, you know, I've got an opportunity to see what I did.
Right, now you speak from successful background.
So effectively early on, feeding them music, not only reading to them, but making up words, making up everything from small flashcards to then once we first started getting our computer, allowing them to actually go on the computer and use it as, you know, at first it was all fun and games. It was typing, it was laughing at pictures. But then what I started doing is taking some of those exercises and doing opposites, like in and out and over and under, and we would keep repeating that. We also pushed them heavily. My son, my oldest, is into web design and graphic arts, and he has blended his music, technology, and love of languages. He studied Chinese, so that he now is able, even as a sociology major in college, able to blend those areas of interest to now a profession. And so I guess my point is, for many of us, and it doesn't have to take an expensive experiment, but rather than just use the cell phone as a communications device, which it is, to also focus on the elements of what that phone can do. What else can you get access to? So I'm just interested now in finding out how we can continue along that vein. If you see the amounts of private equity and venture capital money going into technology, you'll see, I think, great things to come in the near future.
Are you working with teachers, school district, individual parents, or whom are you working with to create this blended learning?
Well, right now what I'm doing is working largely with some other folks who are providers, either of content or folks who are interested, as I am, in bringing blended learning into systems. So I'm not working directly with any end user as much as I am with folks who are looking at the problem and trying to figure out the best ways to solve it.
And to get that particular facility best used and provided with content. Yeah, that's good.
So how does the Core Common Standards impact you, or does it?
Well, it does directly, because ultimately, as they get adopted, you're going to want to... You still have to adhere to that, so you'll have to make sure you provide some way to test kids against what is going to be mandated as proficiency in a particular subject. But what they don't say you have to do is go in any one particular direction. If you are a visual learner and the subject is biology, well, then we ought to be able to do it by pictures, by graphics.
Right.
If you happen to learn more kinesthetically, it may be by doing a series of experiments.
Yep.
The point is, you can, now that the technology exists, and that the big issue is, again, access, just like it is access for parents to have information, it's access to the technology to make sure that that is there. We've got to make sure that you can touch what you need and get what you need in order to build the appropriate approach.
Lee, that's a good point to conclude today's interview on. It's a high note, but I'll tell you what, these last points that we've been discussing are so important, and you're so experienced in that area, hands-on. That's a subject for another interview.
Oh, that would be great to talk to you all again.
Yeah, because that's vital information that parents can benefit from, and it's the sort of thinking that we really ought to be getting into the educational system so that we have better practices of teaching practices, for want of a better word.
Yeah, if we want to make parents consumers, then we also need to get this type of information to them.
And B, we want to make them smart consumers.
Right.
As Barney's would say, select, don't settle. That's what we want.
Yeah. So we've been talking to Dr. Leroy Nunnery, and you can find more about him at his website, www.plusultrellc.net. So thanks, Lee. We're going to do this again.
Thanks for listening to The Learning Curve with Roger and Virginia. For more information on the subjects covered during the show, visit howtolearneasily.com or send an email to questions@howtolearneasily.com.